We are the image of God. That is, we are his physical representatives so that we can rule over creation on his behalf.
The Bible is made for this. Like, it talks about supernatural entities that are real, that aren't imaginary. And I think the church has to wake up to this.
Do you think that whenever she came out of the water, that there was a demon came out of her?
It's like, I can understand that, because our human nature is to, you know, take the blessings that God gives us and then forget about them tomorrow.
There is an intelligence at war against them. And I think what I'm suggesting is that there are still intelligences that we're at war against.
I really like what Dr. Michael Heiser said a lot, is that God's desire is to dwell with mankind forever.
All of the nations in the world have been assigned a particular overseeing guardian to watch over them. But that in particular, the nation of Israel has been designated to be solely God's chosen nation.
The Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone.
But our enemy has not laid down their arms. Their power is broken. Christ is King, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, mighty and awesome.
I was at one time the fastest sword driller in the county.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Two Trees Podcast. I'm John Dillon, and I'm here with Martin Listener.
Hey, all.
And Rose.
Hello, everybody.
Rose Moeller, to be precise.
That's right.
That is correct. And we are back. I have my friends here, finally. We've done some really great interviews. I've had a fun time talking to some really great people, but it's nice to be back here with you guys. Even Jeremy is here, but he's lurking in the background, the unseen listener. You are the... Well, I guess you're
that's
a
normally me.
Too.
Yeah,
I'm the senior listener. Martin listener. Yeah, I see what you did there.
Jeremy's over there to field any phone calls that come in from my kids.
Oh, excellent!
Yeah, usually they shut down the podcast when they call.
I was going to say Father of the Year, but that's obviously me, so can't be two of us. But no, we are excited to be back. We're going to be talking a little bit about the Book of Exodus over the next couple weeks. One of the things that I love doing is I teach on Tuesdays a small group at a local restaurant, and we've been reading through the Book of Exodus verse by verse, and whenever anyone has a question, we talk about it. It's been 2 years of rabbit trails. It's been a lot of fun, but we are fast approaching the end of the book, and I've gotten several questions about the golden calf section of the book, and I didn't get into it as deeply as my love of rabbit trails really will let me do. And so since I have a podcast, we get to do that. And so that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And really part of the hope here is to move us past the flannel graph version of this story. Most of us are introduced to the story of the golden calf, and it goes something like this. God did amazing, wonderful things. They went into the wilderness and Israel forgot. They weren't sure if they believed in God anymore, and so they made up their own God. And it leaves us wondering, what kind of a moron could watch what God did in Egypt, the Red Sea, the feeding of the people, I mean, all this stuff that's going on, the giving of the water, and then think to themselves, okay, we're done with that. And it really always left me feeling smug and superior. Like, well, I may not be an idiot or as big an idiot as I thought I was because these guys, they have no idea what's going on.
Like, if you would have been there, you would have done everything so differently.
If I was there, we would not have done the golden calf thing. And it really has surprised me to dig back into the text, especially having read Michael Heiser's Unseen Realm and gone through and allowing just this idea of the Bible as more than flannel graph, as more than just like a hurry up and get to Jesus kind of moment, but to realize that Jesus is all through this book and that this is not children's literature. This may be taught to children, but it is a very advanced piece of literature, a beautiful piece of art, as well as an accurate retelling of what happened. And there's a lot of really cool stuff that I think is taking place at the Mount Sinai there with a golden calf. Hmm. And really, if you have to boil it down, let me give you the John Dillon version of the story. Israel never ceased to believe in God at Sinai. But what they did is they rejected God's will and his revelation. They desired to be in God's presence. They desired the paradise, the promised land he was talking about. But they didn't understand what God was doing. They didn't approve of what God was doing. And they wanted it on their own terms and in their own way. And
so this is sounding vaguely familiar.
Well, it ought to. What does it remind you of?
Reminds me a little bit of Eden.
Maybe like some two trees
mentality.
Yes. Yeah, like one tree that God says, this is what I'd like you to do. And the other that is mankind defining right and wrong for themselves. Mm. That's exactly what it is. It's a retelling or a reliving, I guess it was. There's nothing new under the sun of, am I trusting God or am I trying to manipulate God to do things my way? Martin, did you do the golden calf on Not Your Average Sunday School?
Nope, didn't get to it yet, but it is in that book. So maybe if we get that podcast up and rolling again, we can have an episode on that. But John, I think it's fantastic that we're going into, you know, stuff like this, because the flannel graph stuff, that's, you know, how I started my podcast and what I really truly believed in, because I had all the knowledge of it growing up, and I knew the flannel graph inside and out, forwards and backwards. But understanding that, you know, Jesus is in those types of stories as well, and how much it relays back to the start in Eden, like we're going to get into here today, but also reflects what we do in our everyday life. You know, when you first told me about the two trees and how, you know, our entire lives are really based around this idea of, are we deciding what is right and wrong, or are we living in God's presence and desiring that? I kind of thought you were a little full of it. I'm like, really? Like, this is what
it's
all about?
That's the reaction most people have to me.
most of the time. But then when you're really diving into it, man, it just makes more and more and more sense, and you can see yourself doing this type of stuff. When I had the privilege of preaching at Covington Christian a couple weeks ago in my prayer, this wasn't something that I designed to say, but what I mentioned is we claim that we want to be with God forever. We claim that we want to go to heaven so we can be in the presence of God forever, and yet we struggle to be in his presence for just 30 seconds in a prayer or in 10 minutes out of our day and this, that, and the other. And it's the same idea with this golden calf you have written down here, that they desired the paradise. They desired the place where they were going to be put, where God was going to take them, but they didn't truly want to be with him. They wanted to be him in his domain.
Yeah, it's
and that's
kind
an interesting
it's the
thought.
Same today. Like if you ask people, you know, what's heaven like? You hear a lot about streets of gold. You hear a lot about angels and choirs and that kind of a thing. One of the things you don't hear a whole lot about is God.
Right.
I mean, he's there, obviously, mm-hmm. but like he's not really the main attraction in most people's understanding of heaven.
And I
think that's partially because of how broken we are. Like if we really
exactly.
understood who God is and could have a clear vision of this, it would be life-changing. You know, it would be the kind of thing that would radically transform your desires.
We talk so much about stuff that we're going to do and how we're going to perform certain duties. And then, of course, well, it's because it's to glorify God, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's always the end, the caveat that we throw on the end there. Like, you know, all to glorify God and all glory to him. But we don't really live with the main objective of our life to glorify the one that created us. And I think your actions change when you can get into that mode better. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I live there frequently. I wish I did more. But when I get into that zone where I'm like really thinking about glorifying God first, I'd have less problems. I have less stuff that comes up. I feel like I'm not, you know, in this way. And I'm not trying to say if you just follow God, all your problems go away by any means. But your mind changes. Your thought process changes with that. And I think if Israel would have been in the mindset of proving to God that he is worthy of all the glory that we can give to them, they wouldn't have found themselves in a bunch of these issues. And they wouldn't have us looking back at them all smug saying, how are you so silly to not let that happen?
Well, and I think the way we present that story really creates this false straw man of stupid ancient Israelites and smart modern people, right?
Bingo.
And we know this, and we would obviously not fall for this. And a large part, I think many people aren't really sure exactly what's going on. Is this that they have forgotten about God, or that they just have real short memories? What exactly is happening? And if I was to explain this to you, and that's what I'm trying to do, I would begin by asking, what exactly did Israel think was happening at Mount Sinai? Like, we see this as a very small piece of a much bigger book. Like, we have in the back of our heads David and the Psalms and the coming prophets and Jesus and the apostles and all of these future events and the theology that comes along with it and all of the extra shading that comes in with the understanding of doctrine as the Bible teaches it. But to an ancient Israelite, what exactly did they know?
So you're saying that we have the privilege of knowing the story. And so it is easier for us to look back and be like, well, duh, you know, because
Exactly.
The hindsight and the entire Bible, like you can buy it literally anywhere right now. And to them, they're living this. They're moving forward into a story, not looking back on it like we are. To be fair, I kind of actually want to give a shout out to Flannel Graphs because I feel like sometimes we run them down a lot. But they do serve a purpose. When you're young, or when you're young in the faith, you need to know the basics, you know, but you don't stay there. You know, you don't stay in the basics. Right. You don't stay in the milk.
So Martin brought that expression up, and I like it because there's nothing wrong with Flannel Graphs or children's Bibles when you're a child. Exactly. But then to assume that there was nothing more to this story and to simply lock it into the same category as like Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the lady that you interviewed, Emily Dixon, she says something about that. She's like, if you need to get a children's Bible in your hands to read it and get the story, then do that, you know? You need to start somewhere. It's like reading Charles and Mary Lamb's like Tales of Shakespeare. Like if you can't handle an entire play, just get that book and read about the story. But then you need to move in further and learn more about what the faith that you profess. And it is a joy to see Jesus come through in the Old Testament. And you're not going to get that if you stay on the Flannel Graph, basically.
No, and it's not intended to do that. But you have people who come away from these Flannel Graph sessions, for lack of a better term, and they consider themselves experts in the text. You know, I know this cold. There's nothing that can surprise me about my Bible. And the whole premise of this podcast is to explore some of the weird and wonderful corners of the Bible. And what exactly they saw as happening at Sinai, I think, is disconnected from the way we would approach this story as pointing to Jesus, and really instead pointing back to Adam and Eve, to lost paradise. We recognize that mankind has lost what we were intended to be, that we were made in the image of God to be in this in-between place, in this garden of abundance, this garden of Eden. And Abraham, their father, was sent by God to wander the earth, to look for a city not made with hands, to bring them back into the promised land. And here they've been living in exile, in slavery, for forever, it feels like. And so I think their view of this must have been looking back and saying, you know, and I think this is an important part to reading the rest of the Bible too, is not just about heaven, but this reestablishment of a new heaven and a new earth, that God created his creation at least in two ways, in a spiritual world and in a physical world. And in the Garden of Eden, mankind walked in both, that we were alive, alert, in a way that we aren't anymore. And that when mankind was pushed out of the garden, we have proceeded to get further and further and further from this Edenic ideal, this place where we were in the presence of God. And ancient peoples talked about Eden as though it was a mountain. Water, as you know, runs downhill, right? And so when you read the book of Genesis and it's describing the Garden of Eden, it says there are four rivers that break off and water the whole earth. One flows north, one south, one east, and one west. And so if you're picturing this in your head, Eden is uphill. But in my mind, growing up because of, you know, childish pictures and that sort of a thing, Eden seems to have been the Bahamas. In like it was this really nice tropical place, and it was beautiful. But it wasn't this same Middle Eastern concept of the dwelling place of the gods. In Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel, or God, is talking there to a rebel, who I think is Satan, and it describes him as having been on the mountain of the Lord, the mountain of God in Eden. And this connects to the way that ancient peoples talked about gods, about the heavens. Gods were seen as living on the tops of mountains. And this seems weird to us, but in the ancient communities that they were looking at, water came down from the mountains. That's where the springs were. There was green growing stuff up on the tops of the mountains. And the further downhill you went, the further away from the water sources you were. Mm-hmm. And so it became a way of talking about beautiful spaces or places where the gods dwelt. Probably the most famous example of this is Mount Olympus, mm-hmm. where the Greek gods were supposedly living. But it connects this idea of ascending back into the heavens. And so when God begins to reveal himself to the Israelites, it makes sense that he would do so at a mountain. Mm-hmm. Why didn't this take place right outside the Red Sea? Like, if it was our culture, that's where we'd put it, like on the beach. Like, well, exactly. Let's have some nice palm trees around, then sling some hammocks. The Lord can visit us here. This is our idea of heaven, or for most people it is. But in that biblical world, they were looking to the mountains as this is a place where the earth and the heavens are touching. Mm-hmm. And so God is speaking to them in a way that they understood. And so by taking them to a mountain, I think they intrinsically knew something that a modern reader is going to push past. They recognize this as connecting to God and humanity coming back together.
So it's a physical space that's saying something spiritual to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's exactly right. A similar way that we do this with like the River Jordan. People talk about going over Jordan in poetry or in songs. When I actually saw the Jordan, it's not a very big deal to actually go over Jordan. Mm-hmm. There's no, like, if it's not a gigantic river. It was nice. I mean, it was very rivery, and I liked it. But it's become more of a symbol than just a river. This is part of that ancient worldview.
And we do that with sacred spaces all over the place, like your church building or your prayer closet or whatever you want to classify anything as, too. But John, when they're going to this mountain, they are feeling probably closer to God, right? This is something that they would expect to see some kind of supernatural event. So I'm getting kind of a little confused here, as like it seems like God is leading them to himself. And right. That's when they turn around and say, no, we need the calf instead.
Oh, the calf we're going to get to. The calf is a weird element of this story.
Am I jumping the gun on
you
that?
You are
a
jumping
bit?
The gun a little bit. But it is, okay. They would have seen themselves as on a pilgrimage. They have crossed the Red Sea. And when we read the story of the Red Sea, many people may not recognize this, but the story is in Exodus two times. The first time it's there, it's given to us in prose. It's a description of what happened. They then get across the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, and Moses sings. He has a poem. He has a song that he poetically retells what just happened. And in the poetic retelling in Exodus 15, 17 through 18, there's a very beautiful verse. Rose, would you read that for us?
You will bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord will reign forever and ever.
So the imagery that Moses is using to describe where they're going is to be planted on the mountain. This is garden language. They are heading to a place where they believe they are going to encounter the Lord high and lifted up. They recognize what's going on. This is Eden flowing backwards. Mankind has been cast out of the garden, and they are being called back into the presence of God. Later prophets are going to use this motif of the garden, of the mountain, and the return to Eden. It becomes a very powerful image that sometimes is talking about Eden, sometimes it's talking about Jerusalem, sometimes it's talking about Sinai, but it's all symbolically talking about something much more than that. Look at the book of Isaiah, chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, Martin.
The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. Then many people shall come and say, Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths.
So obviously Moses would never have read this, but it is written in the voice of someone who has read Moses. They're taking this imagery and not just inventing something new, but this is the way that the Israelite people were talking about these things. They're talking here not about Sinai, but about Jerusalem. And it says that when the Lord is there, it's going to come to pass that this will be the highest of the mountains in the world. Now, I've seen the mountains in Jerusalem, and they're, again, they're very nice, but they're not the highest in the world, mm-hmm. and not by a long shot. Is it saying that God is going to physically alter the state mm-hmm. of the ground there? And what would that mean? Or is it talking about something much greater? To be higher than the others is poetry, as a way of saying that it will become the most important place in the world.
I love that line, and all the nations shall flow to it. It makes them sound like a river.
That's what the word is there mm-hmm. for flow. It actually says that the people shall river up to the mm-hmm. mountain. In the book of Genesis, we have the rivers pouring down. Mm-hmm. And in regular life, we have rivers pouring down. But here the imagery is that of coming back, this new heaven, this new earth, this place where the heavens and the earth touch. Even Isaiah is talking about this. But we, in our culture, we say, well, when you die, you're going to go to heaven. And we forget that the end of the Bible talks about a new heaven and a new earth, that there is a new body that's given, that our goal isn't just to live in heaven, but that there is going to come a completion of the story of the earth as well. Hmm. And so this idea of the mountain becomes a way of visually talking about something much more than just a sacred space, a holy place. It becomes a way of talking about what God is doing in the big plan that he is bringing about mankind to. But I don't think for a minute the Israelites didn't know this. They were aware of this from having been alive in the ancient world. They knew this stuff, and they saw it not just as something metaphysical, but it was really happening to them. They were really going to the mountain where God really was. They were really going to be brought back into the presence of the Lord, just as their ancestors had hoped for ever since Eden.
So did they really think that the garden was on top of the mountain then? Is that what you're
Whether they thought of it as the garden or not, the garden is a way that I used to talk about it, because Eden was the last place in Moses' lifetime that mankind walked with God. They saw this maybe not as the physical location of Eden, but as an Eden-like place.
But they
place
thought it was coming to completion.
Oh, yeah.
Like this is
it.
The story's over.
Yeah. We're going into the promised land, and God is going to bring about the ending of the story.
That's odd to think about it, because we know all the other stuff, right? That's a good point to bring up, because I would never think of like, their expectation going into it is far different than my expectation of them going into it, right? And that's what we're trying to point out here.
Yeah, and I just want to ask, like, what were they thinking they were doing? Because in our mind, they were off to the promised land. They had Joshua in the back of their heads. They're going to kick some Canaanites out of there. Later on, the king is going to be born. And then, you know, thousands of years later, maybe the Messiah is going to show up. And they have this much longer story in mind. When what we find instead is that the storyline that would have been the most natural flow of thought would have looked back to Eden. Is God doing it now? Is it coming about? And in the end, the answer was, he is bringing it about, but not in the way that you're probably thinking is going to happen.
There's a lot of things you could preach on there, John.
Right? Oh, yeah. I'm not going to in this episode, because this is background. And if you think of it, not just as God removing the Israelites from Egypt, but if you view this as God's will unfolding on the earth, we recognize that Satan is going to attempt to resist whatever God is trying to do. And in the book of Exodus, chapter 12 and verse 12, God describes his exodus of the children of Israel out of Egypt, not just as a delivery from a particular place, but from supernatural evil. Mm-hmm. It describes what's going on as a war between God and the gods of Egypt. It describes them as part of spiritual warfare that's taking place. And the geography is connected. The place where Israel is going to, Mount Sinai, is connected in their understanding of the world to supernatural, spiritual warfare. And there is a several places, and I want to kind of look at this for just a moment. At the very end of Moses' life, in Deuteronomy 33, verses 1 and 2, he describes Israel leaving Mount Sinai. And this is what he says. Listen to how this reads in Deuteronomy 33, 1 and 2.
The Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. He came from the 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand.
So the Lord came from Sinai. He dawned from Seir. And these are words that we recognize Sinai, but those other names are throwaway names to us.
Especially if you have to read them out loud for the first time.
Yeah, like, and everyone's like, I think you mispronounced that. And the odds.
I am sorry.
That's why I made you do it.
Yeah, thanks.
But no, where is Seir? What is Mount Paran? And what exactly is going on here? We have, in most of our Bibles, these really awesome maps, right, that have a definite dot. And it says Mount Sinai. Definitely, exactly right here. And I don't actually know where Mount Sinai
that
was.
That is funny, because I was going to ask you, where do you think Sinai was? Do you have a personal
favorite? It's in like
favorite?
The Asia, Egypt area.
Okay, over there.
Over there, yeah.
Okay.
It's nice, but the Bible talks about it being connected in this verse to Seir. And this is a place that is described in supernatural terms here. God is being escorted. He's leaving this mountain. Israel is obviously following him here, but it isn't Israel who's described. It says that there are 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand. We oftentimes think of Israel as like lining up like ducks following the mother duck as they kind of wander around in the wilderness. That's not just what was happening. The court of the Lord was there. What was happening on Mount Sinai? The Lord and his council are there. And as they're wandering through the wilderness, they're with the Lord. And they're described as moving around from place to place. And the place that's described here is Seir. And that has Nephilim connections. It's a weird word. It's maybe not something that's marked in your Bible. It should be. But it is a place that's east of Israel. It's kind of southeast. And let's take a look at another passage in Deuteronomy that talks about this place. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 20 through 22.
It starts off by saying, I don't want to hear anything about big names that you have to
yes.
read off.
Yes, yes. I'm excited to hear you try to pronounce this word.
It is also counted as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim.
Yeah.
A people great and many and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day.
So when it's talking about the history of these places, I don't know if you caught that word for Seir is right there as well, that this isn't just a normal place, that this is a place that's connected to the giant clans. And they're well aware of this because they're physically there. If God is leading us into the wilderness, why is he leading us into a dangerous place? Why is he leading us into a place that's connected to these descendants of the Nephilim, the Rephaim who are here? This isn't just random space out there. It's got Jesus at Caesarea Philippi vibes to it, that he goes into the place he's not welcome to demonstrate his authority and his power. That the Lord doesn't just go where it's convenient to go. That there's a very real aspect of spiritual warfare taking place in the Exodus story, even after the plagues of Egypt. And so what is God up to? He's leading them through the wilderness. He's leading them into places that are sacred to fallen spiritual powers. And when you read this, Israel doesn't come out looking very good. They are a mess. Why did God think that they were going to be loyal? Well, partially because he made them to be. The only reason that Israel isn't faithful is because they don't want to be. The only reason that you aren't faithful is because you don't want to be. If it comes right down to it, the only person that makes you skip loving Jesus is you. You have to exercise control over your own sinful desires and nature and choose who you're going to serve. But Moses is going to talk a lot about this kind of stuff. I know that we often talk about Deuteronomy 32 and the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, especially when talking about God dividing up the nations according to the number of the sons of God. But it actually pulls in this content about the supernatural warfare that's taking place around Mount Sinai. So let's jump into Deuteronomy 32, verses 15 through 21.
But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations, they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw it and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is no God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols.
So it starts out by talking about Jeshurun, and that's a poetic name for Israel. And then there's a little bit of a cultural problem here. Because in our culture, fat is bad. And in this culture, fat means you're well fed. It means you're taken care of. And so what he says here is you grew fat, you kicked, you grew fat and stout and sleek. That's not saying you got lazy and you bloated up, you dirty couch potato. Why don't you give me more active? Mm-hmm. Instead, what it's saying is I took such good care of you. Mm-hmm. You started to fill out, put on weight. You were looking good. And what did you do? You abandoned me. Mm-hmm. You turned to other gods, to strange gods. You sacrificed to demons that were no gods. It talks about God looking down at them and being so disgusted that he turns his back on them. When did this happen? When did Israel worship false gods? Now, if you have the whole Old Testament in mind, well, they did that a lot. There were loads of times where they were worshiping Baal, they were worshiping Asherah, but not in the Exodus story. Mm. In the Exodus story, we've been with them every step of this way. Is there a time when they're literally pursuing other gods? Well, it's gonna, I think, connect to the golden calf story. What exactly were they doing? Did they understand everything that was involved? Were there supernatural players involved in what was happening? Or was it just Israel thinking to themselves, oh, how did we get here? I don't know. I'm pretty sure this golden cow that we just made must have brought us out of Egypt and fixed our problem. But here it's being described in terms of being led astray by a spiritual enemy. That also ought to have Eden-like connections. Mm-hmm. That you were led into temptation, and that even though it results, and if you've read the story, God has a real long talk with Moses, and he says, listen, I was going to go with you like this. I'm not. I'm going to send my angel, and he's going to walk with you. But the original plan is not going to happen because of what you have done. And this golden calf story becomes the pivot for what's happening in this particular part of Israel's story. Are you guys following me so mm-hmm. far? Is this making any sense? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to give you a background here, and I'm jumping all over the place. I'm sure some listeners are out there like, Lord have mercy, who wrote this outline? It is not making sense.
When's a cow come into play here?
There is a cow coming into play, and it is fat and sleek and stout. But this event isn't just Israel doubting God's existence. It's about warfare in the heavens. It's about Israel choosing to define right and wrong for themselves.
There it is again.
It's about the host of darkness and their attempt to derail God's plan with Israel. That's what the golden calf story is about. It isn't just about Israel being foolish. It's another instance where mankind is led astray by a tempter. And the things that they think they're doing aren't really what's happening. Mm. Eve is told, if you eat this fruit, you're going to be like God or like the gods. And she eats it, and all of a sudden, it's not what she thought it was.
Mm. Well, I don't know what every translation says, but one of them says she wanted the wisdom it would give her. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is the lie, that that would be a good thing. It's not that it was untrue. It's whether or not that was the Lord's plan, and it was not the Lord's plan for
so
her.
There's a big argument amongst people who are into the golden calf story about whether Israel was worshiping other gods or whether they were attempting to worship Yahweh as a bull. And whatever, you know, we're going to get into this. I definitely have opinions about it. But even if they thought they were worshiping Yahweh, they weren't. They were rebelling against their king and setting up their own path forward. Mm-hmm. They were taking, they were being deceived again by the enemy that was there. And so if you strip this story away and you leave it just with human beings acting foolish, then yeah, you get this really self-confident boost of like, oh, if I was there, I would never have done that. But yet we do this every single time we think we see what's good and we don't. We believe in ourselves and we say, you know, I obviously would never have this problem. But he that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. We're not sinning because we don't know. Hmm. We're sinning because we don't want to do right.
Because we do know.
It's because we do know.
So, John, I have kind of an analogy on that. I always talk about sports-related stuff. So shout out to all the sports guys out there or girls that are listening. But the deception part of it—
That's very modern of you.
Yes, thank you.
To make that, you know, broader.
The deception part of it translates so well with me in that, in the way of watching film. When I was playing basketball in high school, I always thought that I was doing it right. I was like, you know, I'm in the right spot, I'm making the right pass, I'm taking the right shot. And then at the end of the game, the other team has more points. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. I know that I'm doing the right things, I'm making the right steps, and yet the final score indicates otherwise. And then when you're able to take a step back and you watch the film of the game and you're like, well, what's this number five doing out of position? And why is he not making this pass or making that play? And then you're like, well, wait a minute, I'm number five and I'm not making the right pass. And right, so I was able to deceive myself during the game that I was doing the right thing for the benefit of the team. And then when I'm able to look at it from a different perspective, when I'm able to change my thought process on what's actually happening, I look back and I'm like, man, I was deceived. I thought I was doing the right thing and I was way off the mark with this. And so I think it's just, it's so beautiful to watch Satan work. And I don't mean to say that in a positive light, but
I think we need that on a coffee cup. The Martin listener,
the way that he can make you perceive that you're doing it right, the deception tactics that he, I mean, the Bible says he's more crafty than anybody in any other creation. And so when you can see that or look back on your life and you're like, he's good at his job. He's good at his job, and it takes a lot for us to fight back, and it takes a lot from God. That's why we know we need God's help to help not be deceived with that. But you know, I've been dealing with a lot of stuff with this, and it's just so many times in my life, especially recently, I think, man, I got it all together. I know the answer. I figured it out. Like, follow me because I'm smart enough to get through this with this. And then I look back and I'm like, I was tricked again. I was deceived again, and that's been a real eye-opening situation for me. And so when I read the golden calf, I used to look back and say, those stinking Israelites at it again, trying to do their own thing. But I think with what you're pointing out here, it just kind of adds to my knowledge that I'm gaining here recently of the deception that is there. The Eve was deceived so well. I mean, she's literally with God. And this guy can talk her into doing something that he told her not to do.
Yeah, and the same is true of Israel on the slopes of Mount Sinai. I think they believed that they were to be planted in the presence of the Lord.
And they had it figured out.
They were walking literally with God. Mm-hmm. The Lord was there. They were unlike any other people ever. And yet,
wow.
It's going to not take them long to completely derail this situation. Mm. Rose, go ahead.
Deuteronomy 32:17. I have a bit of a, I'm not sure I understand this verse very well. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. What exactly is he saying there?
Oh, that's a good question. So the word gods there is the word Elohim. It's the normally Elohim in the Bible refers to the God of Israel. But the word Elohim is a much broader word than just the God of Israel. It's a word that can mean a supernatural power,
sure.
A resident of the supernatural world. And so he says, they're sacrificing to demons that were no gods. That's a way of insulting them. These things have set themselves up. And if this place is connected to the Nephilim, to the Rephaim, to Seir, then this would be their space. This is like Jesus crossing the Sea of Galilee and finding the demon-possessed man on the shores of Bashan across the sea. He's purposefully gone into their space. And he says, listen, these are gods that you've never known. These are gods that have come recently. You have no loyalty to these. These aren't yours, but you've rejected me for them. He says, you've turned your back on the rock that bore you. You forgot the God that gave you birth. This is God looking and saying, he's pulling back, I think, the curtain and showing you what was really at stake and what they were really doing. But I think if you had asked any of the Israelites, all in favor of not worshiping Yahweh anymore and worshiping the local rock demons around here, let's take a vote. I think they wouldn't have said it that way,
mm-hmm.
but that doesn't mean that isn't what was happening.
Ask the same question in church today, right? You get the same answer the Israelites would tell you.
Oh, that's why everyone has some Jesus language to sprinkle over their opinion. the holy Febreze, right, that we spray. I'm going to say a couple nice things about this person so that I can insult them really badly later on, and it will balance out the scales. But yeah, I think they...
Not that people listen to this podcast do that.
Mm-hmm. No.
People that you guys know table. About.
Other yeah, people.
Right.
Not you.
Camped
not
out talking about at you. Mountains worshiping devils. Those right. people. Not us, obviously. That's sarcasm out there, so before someone sends me... Some of you guys don't do sarcasm. Mm. Just letting...
Bless their heart.
Bless their heart, mm. Yes, that's...
John lives on sarcasm.
It is my love language.
So the line where it says, whom your fathers had never dreaded, I'm not trying to be too literal here, but would that have been the Egyptian gods that they did dread, and these are new kids on the block in a different territory that they are just now meeting
mm-hmm.
and trying to... worship?
Yeah, well, it calls them literally demons, and
right.
it depends on what you think a demon is. Some people believe that demons are fallen angels. Other people believe that they're the disembodied Nephilim from the flood. And if that's the case, then these are newcomers to the game. They're not original to the storyline. They're not fallen sons of God. They're demons who are at work here.
Hmm.
But anyway, you look at this, this is the wrong side. Israel should have known immediately that this smelled wrong. Hmm. There was something not right about this. They're trying to replace Moses, really, is what's going on here. And I want to just kind of jump into the text a little bit here. It may help us see this a little clearer. What exactly and when in the story did Israel make this golden calf? And what was the circumstances behind it? Because it seems like this massive jump into, yeah, hooray for Jesus, or rather, hooray for Yahweh. You know, we love him. We were worshiping him. Let's make a golden cow. That seems like, how did you get there from there? But if you read the story, there actually is a flow of logic. So let's jump into Exodus 19 in verse 7.
So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak to you and may also believe you forever.
So God doesn't need Moses to run messages, right?
Right.
Why is he letting Moses do that?
Wouldn't that make Moses an angel?
Yeah, in the literal sense there. He's a messenger. He has a purpose. He has a role. He is a representative between God to the people and the people to God. In a very real way, he's acting as a priest.
Well, he also used Moses to speak to Pharaoh. I mean, the Lord could just put the smack down on Pharaoh himself, but he used Moses, in which, to be fair, was actually Aaron, because Moses said, you know, I can't do that. And he's like, here, your brother will do it then. So maybe not quite the same thing, but I feel like Moses kind of has a dual role here of speaking.
Oh, I think so, for sure. There's this element of the prophet as a representative from the divine council to the realm of man and back and forth. And so there is this prophetic role that Moses is given. But he's delivering a message, and the message is Israel's with us. They have sworn. They just said, I do. Is this your God? Is this your covenant? And the Lord is speaking to them very clearly and very powerfully. None of them are left asking, you know, I wonder if that's really God. I wonder if God is real.
Did God really say?
Hath the Lord said? Yeah, that's exactly right. The things that we often accuse God and say, well, if God would just do this, or make himself obvious, then we would return, then we would believe. Mm-hmm. This is just about right out of the words of the rich man in the rich man and Lazarus story. If someone would return from the dead, then they would believe. Mm. And the answer to that is no, they will not. There's always going to be reasons to doubt, always going to be reasons to do the wrong thing. But here the story is pulling us deeper into a relationship. This is unusual behavior. God hasn't shown up like this ever. Ever. Not since Eden has there been a storm like this, where in the winds of the day, Adam and Eve hid themselves. Let's jump down to verse 19.
And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up.
So it's almost as though these two realms, the physical world and the supernatural world, are touching. They're overlapping. God is manifesting himself physically. He doesn't have to do that. The reason he's doing it is for Israel, that they can see this, that they can understand what's happening. Heaven and earth have not touched, not since Eden, not since they walked between the worlds, since mankind was under the trees in the temple of the Lord. The Lord came down to the mountain. And I've always thought this was neat because it implies that God was above the mountains. And so you remember, your gods live on top of the mountains. God is higher than that. He is the God of gods, the Lord of lords. We're not signing off anyone, so just don't get excited about that. But yeah, he's way up there. As a matter of fact, this kind of reads like an un-Babel.
I was just thinking that
event.
I was reading through there.
Where at Babel, they build their own mountain, right, to try to localize the deity. And whether it's God or the gods, they're trying to control the supernatural world. That seems to be not happening here, but God has come to them. They've not gone to him, but he's come to them. Did you catch the part about the trumpets? This isn't Israel blowing the trumpets. This is the heavens blowing trumpets, and they're hearing it. There's another time in the New Testament when there's a sound like a mighty rushing wind.
Thessalonians, it talks about the trumpet of the Lord.
Oh yeah, and that one too. In Acts, when Pentecost happens, it doesn't say there is a wind. It says there's a sound like wind, and there's fire. This is eerily similar. This is as though these two worlds have clashed together again. That man is in the presence of the Lord. So at Babel, mankind sought to manipulate God to draw him back down. This is not God being drawn, but God drawing. He's bringing mankind into his presence to be done in his will. His will be done, not ours. Let's keep going. Let's jump to verse 24.
And the Lord said to him, go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you. But do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. So Moses went down to the people and told them.
So Moses is going back and forth, and you might think to yourself, well, Moses is the only guy who's going to get to be involved in this at all. That's not the case. It doesn't happen all in a hurry, but other people are going to be brought into the presence of the Lord. Now, it does say, don't let the priests and the people break through. Don't everyone just run up here because this is sacred. This is special. I'm not going to allow you to treat this casually. This is special. And so he invites Aaron to come up there. This is God not lifting the veil all at once, but slowly. He's bringing more and more people into his presence. In Exodus 24, verses 9 through 11, the elders of Israel are brought up on the mountain, and they have a meal. Later on, Jesus obviously is the ultimate fulfillment of this. The temple veil is torn. Mm-hmm. Jesus is literally there. What our eyes have seen and our ears have heard and our hands have handled of the word of life. This is God bringing himself back into fellowship with man. I do have a question for you guys. Look down in verse 24, and it says, do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord. And this is going to be important for next week, because Levi...
So you better get it right, Rose.
Mm.
Levi...
You first.
...is typically the priestly tribe. But up until this point, Levi has not been selected to be the priestly tribe. Mm. There is no priests in the Levitical sense yet. Who are these priests?
Hmm. At first, I would have said the elders that they were talking about earlier.
It could right. be.
That would be my first guess.
These are men and maybe women who are having their job is to represent God to the people and the people to God. They're not Levites. They could have been from any number of places. But these are people who have an invested interest and an opinion about how to deal with the spiritual powers mm-hmm. around you.
So would they have been remnants when they came out of Egypt? Somebody mm-hmm. who did some kind of spiritual, I don't know, activity?
Yeah, it could have been.
Israelites while they were living in Egypt?
It's very possible that that's exactly who this is. That these are people who, like Balaam later on, are going mm-hmm. to have a knowledge of the supernatural world. Now, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and pretend like they're all wonderful, sweet, charming, Jesus-loving people. But who is it that comes to Aaron in just a few pages here and says, up, make us gods? Like, where did these guys come from? And why does Aaron listen to them? It's as though somebody comes to him who has supernatural information. And these people, it's interesting to me that God doesn't say, hey, bring those guys up here on the mountain. It's almost as though the Lord saw their hearts and understood what was happening, that this was not yet time for everyone to just river up the mountain. Like it says in Isaiah, this wasn't that mountain, but it was a mountain, and things are moving in that direction. And so Moses goes up the mountain.
That kind of reminds me of a New Testament passage, and I know I'm going to get it wrong, and I don't know the reference, but when it talks about the Lord will give you all the desires of your heart,
mm-hmm.
that kind of reminds me of that here, because that verse is really often taken out of context where— It's kind of like, you know, if you just pray and love God, he's going to give
Browns
you
Browns will win the Super Bowl.
Everything you want, right? But realistically, the way I perceive that is saying if you align your heart with the way God wants your heart to be, all of a sudden everything is yours. Mm-hmm. Everything is yours. And it seems like that's what these priests were doing. God saw that their heart was not in alignment, so you can't come up here yet. Like you have some work that needs to be done before you can enjoy all of this, which is what you really want.
It could be, you know, that at that moment they were all in a good place. It's just that God was limiting how this was going. Do you remember the story of the Transfiguration?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus doesn't take all the disciples up the mountain.
Sure.
He limits who's there. This is a pattern. This is art. This is God unfolding things. I think this really happens, okay? So when I say art, I don't mean pretend. I mean the Lord is doing something beautiful. And there's a pattern to this, that the Lord is bringing them back one by one and two by twos, and then 74 or 72 of them are up there on the mountain. There's this beautiful progression of things. But what happens with the golden calf is mankind says, that's enough. Let's do it this way. Yeah. I have a better way. So Moses, oh, go ahead, Rose.
I was going to ask a clarifying question.
Yeah, go ahead.
In verse 24, the people break through and the Lord break out. Are you saying that what would be broken would be the veil that was put between them? Is because I know you referenced Jesus in the temple.
Yeah, I think so the veil is a good way of describing that. It's setting up liminal space. He's saying, I am here and I've come for you. This is a sacred space. This is a sacred place. Don't treat it as though it's not. Don't come in here. Just like later on with the temple, not everyone is permitted to go into the Holy of Holies. You have to acknowledge the Lord in certain ways before you go in. Mm-hmm. It's a way of showing loyalty. It's not that actually bathing in the mikveh spiritually makes you fit to go into this space. But it's saying, just like the Lord told Moses, take the shoes off your feet, for the ground on which you stand is holy ground. God gives them a way to show loyalty. Hmm. Just like he did in the garden, when he gave them a tree and said, do not eat from this tree. It's a loyalty oath. If you eat from this, you are breaking covenant with me. There is a way for you to show love to me.
So is he testing their obedience?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yes, he is. Hmm. Also, I think that it would have been dangerous for them to just go running up on the mountain. Apparently, there were 10,000s of his holy ones who are also there. The Bible talks about that in Eden. When mankind is pushed out of Eden, cherubim are placed at the gate. Now, I don't think this is physically where Eden was, but it's almost as though God can make Eden wherever he is. Jesus is like a mobile Eden wherever he goes. So is Abraham. There's an abundance wherever he is. This isn't about rediscovering the actual garden layout and that kind of a thing. Instead, this is saying, where is the Lord? And how can mankind again fellowship with God? Mm-hmm. And so there's this sacredness that's set up around the mountain. And so if you can imagine, the mountain is flashing fire. There are trumpets. There's the sound of a host on the mountain. There is smoke, there is fog, there is a warning, don't get too close to the mountain or you'll die. And Moses goes up the mountain and disappears into the smoke. And he is gone for 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know about you, but I would consider that an excessive amount of time.
Yeah, he ain't coming back, right? That would be my thought.
Like if I sent you,
he fell in.
Like to go up on that mountain where all the creepy, crazy stuff is happening. Like, how long do we wait for him to come back down? 41 I mean, around like day three, I'm getting antsy.
Yeah.
Day seven, where I'm thinking, well, it's a week. You know, maybe there's like some. What about day 20? Like, they're looking at this mountain, and there's got to be people whose job is like Moses watching. Like, can we spot him? Like, is he coming down? Where is he? Why can't we see him? And it says that he's gone. Look at what happens. And this is the beginning of the golden calf incident.
So this thought just pops into my head, and I know this is completely sci-fi-ish. So maybe the blurry creature guys will talk about it some, but is there some kind of like time dimension difference? Like,
oh, and this keeps coming up.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think there is.
He's really up there for like 5 minutes, but it's 40 years or
like
40
Narnia.
Days our time. You
yes,
know, like
I
that.
Think so. Can I prove that biblically? No, I cannot.
Interstellar type of stuff
There's
going on.
There's something funky going on this mountain. And again, I think Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration, and one of the guys he's talking to up there is Moses. Mm-hmm. That's not Mount Sinai, but he's in the presence of Moses. So whether Moses is like, this seems familiar.
Is that when Moses goes up on the mountain now is the same time Jesus went up on the mountain then?
It's possible.
You got this whole,
there's this weird time thing.
Exactly.
Time this is not our thing. I love a good random ramble, but I have no proof
of
that.
That's the two trees
all.
After dark.
Yeah.
You can subscribe to that.
There's no reason it couldn't be. He got up and was like, who's this wild-looking guy? This Elijah guy? Right. I don't know. But something happens. Moses is gone an incredibly long time. And they think he's dead. They don't think, well, things must have, you know, what they think is something must have gone wrong. Hmm. Moses must have messed up. Moses is not who we thought he was. This is more dangerous than we thought. Something is wrong. Someone needs to do something. Because if it gobbled up Moses, we're all sitting here at the bottom of this mountain. What if it comes down? What if the Lord comes down? What if the host comes down? What if the beings who are already here come out? What if we've lost the favor of the Lord and suddenly they begin to fear? They begin to walk in uncertainty and they don't know what's happening. I said no, as in like the tree of knowledge. I don't know if anyone's going to catch this or not. But jump down to verse 24. No, we already read that.
We already read it.
Yeah, let's go to 32, verse 1.
When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, "Up, make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him."
So this is 40 days and 40 nights. Back in Exodus 24, it says Moses entered the cloud and went up the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. By the way, that time period should make you think of Noah and the rains of the flood. He's been up there way too long. He's got to be dead. Mm-hmm. And they're afraid. And a group of people approach Moses. Now, it says the people. The people gathered themselves together. Now, is this every single Israelite? Probably not. This is a big group of them, though. These are the leaders of Israel. If I had to guess, these are the priests that are being talked about before. These are the spiritual leaders of the community. Probably the elders are involved here. These are the people who know something about how to deal with the supernatural world. And what they say is, make us gods. Now, is this plural or is this singular? And the answer is, it depends on how you want to read it. Elohim can be singular or it can be plural. There's an odd version of this that's found in the book of Nehemiah that reads singular. This seems to be reading plural, but however you read it, this is a drastic change in strategy. We do not know what's happened to Moses. Make us an idol. We know how to deal with those. Are you following me so far? I hope this is helping you see this as more than just Israel didn't believe in God anymore. They definitely believe in God. But now they're trying to control things. It's not going to go well. As a matter of fact, there's about to be a war that breaks out. I think it's more than just a physical war. I think there is a supernatural cause and effect that's happening here.
I feel like you're doing a spoiler for the next time.
Well, believe it or not, most people have read this story.
It's been around a while.
It's been a while. It's not come out recently.
Right.
But we will jump into this next week. And in the meantime, my friends, I'll be praying for you. I hope that you're having a wonderful day and that the Lord is gracious and kind to you and that you remember that Jesus is the Lord of lords, the God of gods, mighty and awesome.